This podcast was recorded at the 2015 JADPRO Live SNAPSHOW Conference. The title of this session is The Science Behind Biologics and Biosimilars, and it is presented by Kelly D. Maiden, MSN, FNP, AOCNP, Wellmont Cancer Institute. To view the presentation slides or to claim continuing educational credit for this activity, please visit www.advancedpractitioner.com/JADPRO Live 2015. And now we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Thank you, Chris. Confucius once said that life is really simple, but we insist on making it complicated. Likewise, there was a day and age when drug development and manufacturing was really simple, but we've insisted on making it complicated. Or as Emeril Lagasse likes to say, we've kicked it up a notch. So I invite you to stay tuned, and I think at the end of the presentation, you'll agree with me that the science behind biologics and biosimilars is very complicated, but it's very important in that it's produced some of the greatest life-saving therapeutics we have, and it certainly has been instrumental in improving our patient outcomes. I have only one financial disclosure. You see from the learning objectives in front of you, we have a very ambitious agenda. We'll start with an audience response question. Using your telephone, please answer, in regard to drug approval pathways, which of the following statements is true? Generic small molecule drug approval and biologic drug approval are granted under the Hatch-Waxman Act. Generic small molecule pathway approval eliminates the requirements for phase 3 clinical trials. The biosimilar approval pathway eliminates the testing requirements that define an agent's PK and PD properties. The biosimilar approval pathway ensures that an agent is interchangeable with the innovator brand name product. Okay, so we'll talk about the answer, but I think at this point, most of us agree that biotechnology has been instrumental and revolutionized the treatment of many chronic and acute illnesses for our patients in the fields of rheumatology, endocrinology, nephrology, and most notably for us, oncology. The science of creating therapeutics in living systems has carved out a unique space that requires us as advanced practice providers to have an understanding of everything from generic drug manufacturing to the global biosimilar market. So I thought it prudent not to put the cart before the horse, but to unearth the roots of the tree and see what has actually given life to the current biotechnology and biosimilars market. So when you think of traditional drug development, this begins well before a sponsor goes to the FDA submitting an investigational new drug application. There's preclinical animal testing, consideration for safety, feasibility, etc. But once an investigational new drug application is received, the sponsor can then move its drug across the state lines for testing purposes. After that is accomplished, then phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials will take place. And this is where we'll determine the safe dosage of the drug. We'll look at adverse events. We'll determine the efficacy through this process. And this takes about 1, 2, and 3 years, respectively. At this point, hopefully, data is favorable, and the sponsor goes back to the FDA and files a new drug application for the indication in which it was testing the medication. After that, the drug is marketed, and this is when it receives a patent, and hopefully the developer can recoup some of the monies it has put into the research of the medication. At this point, phase 4 clinical trials are also going on, and this is sort of like our post-marketing trial that we're all involved in, where we continue to look for adverse events or things that weren't recorded in the clinical trials because the drug is being introduced into larger and larger numbers of the human population. So you can see from its inception to its end, this is a very involved process, and it requires not only on the part of the sponsor a commitment of time, it also requires a commitment of money. So new drug development can be expensive. Most of us have grown up in the age of generic drugs. So our familiarity with generic drugs doesn't really make us think about these on a day-to-day basis. We're familiar with generic drugs. We know they've saved our healthcare system millions, well, probably billions of dollars. So we don't tend to think about it. But it's interesting to note that at one point, if a sponsor wanted to develop a generic drug, they would have to go through the same laborious process that we just talked about. So, of course, there wasn't a lot of incentive to sponsors to develop generic drugs because it was still very expensive. And all that changed in 1984 with the passage of the Drug Price Competition and Patent Term Restoration Act, or the act that we refer to as the Hatch-Waxman Act. This created an abbreviated new drug application for generic approval. This was the 505 pathway. This eliminated the need for preclinical animal and clinical human drug testing in order to establish safety. Now, a generic product still has to be proven to be bioequivalent with a brand name product, but a generic product will be equal to the brand name product. If it gets generic approval, you can find information about that in the approved drugs product with therapeutic equivalence evaluations, or what we call the Orange Book. Generic drugs, it's important to note that they are small molecule drugs. They're really simple in nature. Molecularly, they are not sophisticated. And that's why we can synthesize them in exactness in the laboratory. So these are chemically synthesized so that generic drug A, generic drug B, generic drug C looks just like the brand name drug. So it doesn't matter who's manufacturing it, it's all going to look the same. And that makes proving that the drug is equal very easy. We have the analytical tools to do just that. So a generic drug is scrutinized by the FDA. Just because it's generic does not mean the FDA does not scrutinize the process. They do. And what must happen is that this drug, generic, must have the same strength, dosage, form, route of administration, and purity of the brand name product. But again, that's not so hard to do because they're really unsophisticated drugs. So we know by this happening that we have had a savings of lots of money for our healthcare system. So that was the simple. Now we're going to fast forward to the complicated and talk about biopharmaceuticals, starting with biologics. Up front, we have to say that biologics are not generic drugs. That's an important point to remember. Why are they not generic drugs? Well, they're very sophisticated. They have a molecular structure that is makes them very complex, and you cannot synthesize them to exactness like you can a generic drug. Because of their structural and molecular complexity, these are protein in nature, and so protein always has the potential for variance in terms of what a protein does. This is a living, breathing molecule, if you will, because it's produced in living systems, be that bacteria, yeast, virus, or whatever living system it is. So there's potential for variance so that no two drugs or batches of drugs may ever truly be exactly alike. So we can't just rubber stamp them like we do generic drugs. Because of their complex protein nature, they possess the potential for variance, and that means, again, they can't be exactly alike. And when introduced into human subjects, they have the potential to create an immunological reaction. That reaction may be stimulating the body to produce antibodies against the drug, which would render the drug ineffective, and that's certainly going to affect our patient's outcome. It might cause an anaphylactic type of reaction, or it can even do a cross reaction where the drug is introduced into the body and it may make antibodies that attack proteins that look like the drug. And there was a case of that in the European market where there was a biological form of erythropoietin alpha introduced, and this caused pure red cell aplasia in a number of patients. And what that teased out to be was there was a change in the manufacturing process where polysorbate was introduced, and it caused the leaching of the syringes in the packaging system, and this caused people to have a reaction and develop pure red cell aplasia. So again, these drugs can be not just molecularly sophisticated and complex, but they have the potential to cause an immunogenic reaction. Things that you're probably familiar with in terms of what are biologics are blood and plasma products, vaccinations, monoclonal antibodies, we're all probably very familiar with those, cultured cellular and tissue products, and non-recombinant and recombinant proteins. So when you think about that difference in a generic drug and a large biologic drug, it's like looking at a bicycle versus a Learjet. So you take aspirin, which is a common generic drug. It's about 21 atoms or approximately 20 Daltons. Very simple, unsophisticated, easy to reproduce. Then you look at a large IgG antibody, and it's about 25,000 atoms or over 20,000 Daltons. And if you look at the structure and the complexity here, this is protein folding at its best. These drugs fold and have a potential for their own life, and it's very, very complex. And so that's what gives rise to the difference in generics and biologics, and why we can't say biologics are generics. How important might this be to us or our patients to know about this or talk about it? Well, if you look at the global sales in U.S. billions from the top-selling drugs in 2013, you probably see some we're all very familiar with. For example, bevacizumab, infliximab, pegfilgrastim, rituximab, and trastuzumab. So a large percentage of cost went into purchasing these drugs. If you like to bring it down to the clinical level, you can look at it in terms of clinical drug expenditures. So in the first 9 months of 2013, this is a representation of the clinical expenditures of these medicines. So obviously, these medicines are costing the healthcare system a large amount of money. And we all know that when drugs are very expensive, because biologic drugs are very expensive to manufacture, especially when you compare that to generic drugs. So when we have something that costs a lot, it invites scrutiny from third-party payers, which can ultimately deny our patients access for the medication, or if we're able to get some patient assistance like we were talking about in the panel discussions, then sometimes there's a delay of treatment. So the expense of a drug can limit access for the patient. So it's reasonable at this point that somebody would come up with the idea and say, well, why can't we just make a generic? Well, we can't do that because biologics are not generics. So then it would be reasonable for somebody to say, well, can't we just have a conceptual model, like a conceptual generic? Can't we do something like that? And the answer to that would turn out to be, yes, we can have a conceptual model like that. They're not going to be generics, but we can have something similar. And in that became the birth of the era of biosimilars. How important might this be in terms of cost savings? Well, if you look at the patents that are going to expire on biologics before 2020, and a couple of these already have, it could be really important. If we could save cost on these drugs by having a conceptually similar product, which is not generic, but conceptually similar, we have the potential to decrease cost, and that will ultimately increase access for our patients. So this is what has led way to the first biosimilar approved in the U.S., and we will be seeing additional biosimilars in the future. Your next audience response question asks, which of the following statements best describes biosimilars? Biosimilars exhibit molecular complexity and can be sensitive to changes in the manufacturing process. Biosimilars are approved following the completion of phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials. Biosimilars all exhibit unusual adverse effects as compared with reference products. Biosimilars are expected to increase our national healthcare cost. Okay, so 81% of the room answered the first one, so we'll talk about it. So when we talk about biosimilars, again, up front, important to note that these are not generic medications. Biosimilars, like biologics, are molecularly complex therapeutic proteins that are manufactured in living systems. So they're going to possess that same potential for variance, and also that same potential to have the ability to create an immunologic reaction when introduced into the body. So by definition, a biosimilar is a drug that will be shown to be highly similar to the reference product or originator product, so the branded biologic, which has went off patent. So you can think of a biosimilar like a new version of an existing biologic that had went off patent. So highly similar means what? Well, highly similar means it can have some differences in minor and active components that can't have clinically meaningful difference, but it must be the same in terms of safety, purity, and potency. So the biosimilar product must be proven to be the same as the reference product. Here in the U.S., of course, everything is abuzz about biosimilars. This is a hot topic right now, and it's in the limelight. This is the biosimilar limelight in the U.S. because we saw the launch of the first biosimilar this year. But we are not the first people to have the experience with biosimilars, and we were able to look to the European experience to gain a lot of experience for our own regulatory pathway and the introduction of our first drug. Europe actually introduced its first biosimilar, a drug called Omnitrope or somatotropin, in 2006. I think Europe, as of last week, has 19 biosimilars that are currently being used. It has saved their healthcare system about 30%, so that's been a huge savings. What we really learned from the European experience is that they've had over 400 million patient days of clinical experience. And out of those clinical experiences, they have not seen any difference in terms of comparing the reference biologic to the biosimilar in terms of adverse events or unexpected events. So that can make us feel really good about the safety and the safe introduction of biosimilars for our patient population. In Europe, there's a very strict approval process for this from the European medicine agencies. And if a drug gets biosimilarity, it's been through a very rigorous process. Australia also adopted a similar process, and then here in the U.S., we also have adopted a process similar to the Europeans. Now, biosimilars are marketed in other countries, anywhere from Australia to South Korea. If you like to look at it on a global map, it can look like this. But what's important to remember is that manufacturing is not standardized. There's not a standard regulatory pathway that occurs in every country. And so some countries have not even enacted an approval pathway. So you want to know, when you're thinking about a biosimilar, where was it manufactured? Was there a regulatory pathway? What's ensuring the quality? What's ensuring the biosimilarity of this drug as compared to the reference product? You'll also note that different places call these different things. For example, in Canada, they call them subsequent entry biologics. The European Union calls them similar biological medicinal products. Here in the U.S., we call them biosimilars, or you can also refer to them as follow-on biologics. It's all the same thing. Your next audience response question, ask which of the following are true about biosimilars. A biosimilar is highly similar to an already FDA-approved biological product. A biosimilar is a generic equivalent of the reference product. Biosimilars are similar to reference products in terms of safety. And biosimilars are a new version of an existing biologic whose patent has expired. Great. We know that a biologic and biosimilar are not generic equivalents. So the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act of 2009 was an amendment to the Public Health Service Act. And this was legislated in 2010 under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that was signed into law, or what most of us refer to as Obamacare. But what this act did was it created an abbreviated drug approval process for biosimilars, the 351 pathway, if you will. So this is the language from the amendment, and it's important to make sure we do have a clear definition of the biosimilar. So I like to use the exact language. And the language says that the term biosimilar or biosimilarity in reference to a biological product that is subject of an application under Section K, which is the 351K pathway, means that the product is highly similar to the reference product or the branded product or the originator product, notwithstanding minor differences in clinically inactive components, and that there cannot be any clinically meaningful differences between the biologic and the reference product in terms of safety, purity, and potency. So now most people are saying, well, how do you know that if that's what they say? How can you determine that that is correct, and how does that happen? And I'm going to show you that. The other thing that this act did was set forth a definition of interchangeability, and we'll talk about interchangeability in just a little bit. Next audience response question. Which of the following statements is not true regarding biosimilar products? They are produced through recombinant technology and biosynthesis. The manufacturing process has been standardized among manufacturers. Biosimilar production involves cell expansion and purification. Changes in the production process can have an effect on the biological and clinical activity of the final product. Okay, and the answer to that was that we can have variability. Sorry, there we go back. That the manufacturing process has not been standardized, and therefore we can have variability. So most of you guys got that, 52 to 53%. That's great. Okay, so when you look at biosimilar development, it's important to remember this is a highly technical process. A lot of money is invested in the development of the product and the output of the product. And so when we think about that, and I'll take you through the process, this process is it's much harder than just a generic synthesis. So how much cost savings we'll get from this conceptually similar product is still yet to be determined, because we only have our first biosimilar this year. But the process begins at the beginning, and you have to have scientists and the techniques to isolate a protein of interest. So remember, these are proteins, living, breathing things grown in living systems. So you isolate that protein of interest. You're going to introduce that into some type of living vector. That vector then will take the protein, the gene has been isolated for the protein, start cellular replication, which involves translation, and then you're going to have replication of this protein product. People will transfer this into a culture-type media, and what you're looking for is that perfect protein product. All of this is being tested every step of the way. Once you have your perfect protein product, then you're going to create your master cell banks, so that you'll come back to these master cell banks for every line of this product that you will produce in the future. So that sounds like, well, you get the master cell bank, it all should be the same. Again, no two cell lines will ever be the same. No two products are going to be the same, even if they come from the same cell bank, because they're living, breathing, molecular entities. So there's always room for a little variance. Sometimes that variance is really insignificant, and everything works out fine. So you go on and you do cell expansion. The manufacturer is trying to get more and more product. And this is where they're going to control the temperature, the pH, the nutrients, and the oxidation. So a change in any of these things can affect a change in the product. The final up step would be where the product is transferred into these large bioreactors. So we've gone from something like a vial of product to this bioreactor, which can hold 10,000 milliliters of product. And again, replication is continuing here. Once this is completed, you have to recover that product. So people will recover through a process called filtration or centrifugation. Once you get your product recovered, you still have to be sure this is a pure product. You don't want any impure proteins because that could cause variability and also immunogenicity. So you have to make sure that this is purified. So this is done through processes like gas chromatography, looking at this. Then you get a product that you can actually store some of it, or you can package it in fill systems and you can send it to the market. So you can see from the beginning of this process to the end of this process, this is highly technical, expensive. The equipment involved alone in recovering the protein product is very expensive. The other thing you have to remember is that, you know, if a manufacturer wants to manufacture a biosimilar like a reference product, he's not going to be able to just call up a drug manufacturer and say, hey, could you send me over a vial of that drug you got? I'd really like to copy your cell line so I can make my own cell line and make money. So that's at the front end where that has to be identified, and you hope to get exactly like the reference product you're trying to duplicate. When you think about things that could affect the final product variability, there are external and internal factors. External factors have to do with the expression system, purification process, growth conditions, and product storage and transport. You heard about the example from the European market earlier where they changed polysorbate and put it in a fill syringe, and that led to the reaction. Any of these things that change can affect the product. And sometimes people say, well, why would anybody change anything if you've already got a product? And why would they want to change anything? Well, sometimes a manufacturer might want to increase yield of their product. So they might change a growth factor, or they might do something like this. This may affect biosimilarity. If it affects it in a large way, the FDA may require that this manufacturer go back and prove that the drug is still biosimilar. Things that can affect the internal process are from the protein itself. So anything from the initial amino acid sequencing, where there's the addition of a sugar with glycosylation, to bonding, all the way up to lipidation, methylation, etc. All of this has to do with the protein itself, how it goes from a simple amino acid structure to a complex three-dimensional structure where it's folding and folding to where you can have up to 40 amino acids folded on themselves to give you that beautiful complex structure that you saw on the slide that looked like the jet plane. So the protein itself can live and breathe and cause variants. So how do we establish biosimilarity? How can you know that this product is biosimilar and you can use this with your patient? Well, the FDA recommends a stepwise approach, and the FDA says to sponsors, we want you to come to us at the very beginning. We don't want you to wait. We want to walk with you step by step through this process of your identification of the protein of interest through the manufacturing process. Then the FDA will look at the totality of the evidence. So a biosimilar is going to be approved based on totality of the evidence. Where will that evidence come from? It's going to come from analytical studies, animal studies, and human studies. So that will tease into the analytical characterizations, which are structural and functional. So this is what manufacturers are doing, and this is what the FDA is looking at. So when you think of the structural characterization, that begins with your amino acid sequencing, and the reference biologic and the biosimilar must have the same amino acid sequence. They will then look at the higher order structures of protein folding all the way up to the quaternary structure and look at any of these processes that the protein itself could do to cause variants. In terms of functional characterizations, this will consist of in vitro and in vivo studies. The in vitro studies consist of, but they are not limited to this, enzyme kinetics, biologic assays, and binding assays. In vivo studies are going to be studies that are done in animal disease models where they're going to be looking at this biosimilar versus the reference drugs, pharmacodynamics, and also efficacy. If your structural and functional data are really good, the FDA looks favorable on that, and in the end, it will mean you may not have to do as much testing to prove biosimilarity. Animal data will require pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetic studies. The FDA may look at your animal pathology, histopathology, and you do have to have an assessment of immunogenicity in the animal models. This is very important because this is what we're concerned about with these living, breathing entities. Human studies are also required, and having PK and PD studies in the animal population does not negate the need for that in the human population. So we will have human pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic studies. And I hope that my pharmacy colleagues in the room will forgive me when I really simplify this down. You know, they're the PK-PD experts. But when I say that, when you think about pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics, it represents what the drug does to the body and what the body does to the drug. So you have to look at that in terms of the reference product and the biosimilar to make sure these things are very, very similar. In the human population, we also have to assess immunogenicity, and then they will require a comparative clinical study. If all of this is favorable, they'll probably grant a biosimilar status, but at this point, the FDA can say to a sponsor, we don't think your drug is biosimilar, and we want more data, or they can even say, we just recommend you abandon the process altogether. Last audience response question asks, which of the following best describes extrapolation? Substitution of a reference product in place of a biosimilar by a pharmacist, use of a biosimilar for an off-label indication with third-party payment approval, licensure of the proposed product for one or more additional conditions for which the reference product is licensed, adverse event reporting based on the extrapolation of symptoms from a drug recipient. Okay, so 64% said licensure of proposed product for one or more indications in which the reference product is licensed. So this is the language from the approval pathway that describes extrapolation, but if you want to make it simple, here's what it means. The sponsor who is developing the biosimilar is going to test this biosimilar and compare it to the reference product in one of the indications in which the reference product was licensed. So if all of that is favorable, they are granted biosimilarity, the drug appears to do what it does in each patient population, they can then ask for an extrapolation of the other indications. So that means if drug A, the reference drug, had four indications and the biosimilar was tested in one indication, but there's a biosimilarity is proven, they can have those other indications extrapolated over to the biosimilar. So some people aren't really comfortable with that, some people are, but again, that's a place where we can look at cost savings, because if a manufacturer doesn't have to go back and test in every indication for a biosimilar, that's going to equal cost savings, which hopefully will be passed on to our patients. Interchangeability is a very controversial topic right now. Again, the legislation put forth a definition of interchangeability. And interchangeability simply means this, that if a biosimilar is proven to be exactly like the reference product, in every case it performs like the reference product, it's expected to not do anything different than the reference product, then it can be termed interchangeable. And if a drug is termed interchangeable, a biosimilar, it can be substituted at the level of the pharmacy without the knowledge of the healthcare provider or the person that was prescribing the medication. So if you prescribe the reference biologic for your patient, but they get to the pharmacy and it's considered interchangeable, the pharmacist could substitute that drug for what you wrote without having to notify you as the healthcare provider. Now, interchangeability, whether it will or will not come to fruition in the U.S., we don't know because, again, we only have our first drug, and the first drug did not receive an interchangeable status. In fact, I don't even think the manufacturer submitted for interchangeability, and I don't think that the FDA encouraged that because I don't think the FDA really is even clear on how we are really going to say a drug is interchangeable. What are their exact and specific criteria? Right now, they'll approach you on a case-by-case basis. But again, interchangeability, we'll have a lot of controversial issues in the future. In other words, how many times can you interchange a drug? How many times can you switch a drug? Who's recording that? Are they recording it correctly? How do we know if something happens in terms of adverse events? Do we really know which drug it was? So we'll see. This is something to watch in the days to come. So this year we did have the launch of our first biosimilar in the U.S. This is Zarxio. It was approved March 6, 2015, and it was launched September 3, 2015. You'll note it looks a lot like filgrastim, which is its reference product. Has a little bit of a different looking name, but its packaging is similar, dosing is similar as well. So when you think about biosimilar nomenclature, how are we going to tell these drugs apart? How are we going to keep up with all of that? When this drug was being developed, this is what was accepted, was it had its non-proprietary stem of filgrastim and a four-letter, small-letter suffix. This is currently, and then, what the FDA recommends, that the drug will have a non-proprietary stem and a four-letter, little-letter suffix so that we can know which product is which. Now, in August of 2015 this year, the FDA issued its draft guidance on the non-proprietary naming of biologic products. And in that draft guidance, it says that the four-letter suffix, little letters, will have no specific meaning, will have no ability to tie the drug to anything. So I'm not really sure where this will go in the future, because SNDZ means something to me, and it probably means something to you. So I don't know, does that get changed in the future? Not sure. Going forward, because the draft guidance did come forth, you will see these non-proprietary stems with these four-letter small suffixes that should not mean anything about the drug. The other thing that came from that draft guidance that will be interesting in the future, we don't know how they're going to do this, when they're going to do it, and how it will take place, is that they want biologic products to also have the four-letter small-letter suffix. So what that will mean for us as we go forward is we have to be very careful in documenting about what we're giving, even if it's the reference product, and make sure we have the right name and all those things. But if a drug is biosimilar or biologic, you can find that information in the Center for Drug Evaluation and Research's book called the Purple Book. So not the Orange Book, but the Purple Book. There you'll find the drug's name, its proprietary name, its non-proprietary name, when it was licensed, and does it have biosimilarity and interchangeable status, or just one or the other. So in the example of our first drug that was launched, it's Zarxio with the non-proprietary stem filgrastim, SNDZ, as the four-letter suffix. It was licensed 3615, and it is designated as a biosimilar, not interchangeable, but a biosimilar. So to sum it up, what are the implications for us as advanced practice providers? I have a couple of references here for you. The first one is from Andrew Zelentz, and he's from Memorial Sloan Kettering, and him and his colleagues came up. They wrote this white paper in 2011. It was really intended to look at the issues about safe introduction of biosimilars into our patient populations. It's still a very relevant document. It has a lot of good information about what are the issues at hand, and they're still very relevant issues today. But one thing that came from this study is they looked at 277 providers, which were nurses, pharmacists, physicians, and some non-clinical folks, and they asked them about biosimilars and biosimilar legislation. And unfortunately, more than half the people really were not well informed, and what the document indicated was that education on biosimilarity, biosimilars, and biosimilar legislation is suboptimal. So as advanced practice providers, our first responsibility is to get educated. Fast forward to 2014, a study by Doliner and Riley. This was, again, a European market study, but why is that important? Because they've had more experience. They've been doing this. People have been prescribing biologics and biosimilars longer. So in 2014, and from 2012 to 2014, you think people would have learned a little bit more. But even in the people that were prescribing there, again, almost half, and this was a group of physicians, 477 physicians, almost half of them said they only had a basic understanding of biosimilarity and really needed more information. And in this group, across five countries in Europe where they're prescribing things, 4% of them could not even identify what a biosimilar was or define it in any way. So education needs to improve in terms of biosimilarity, especially as we have our first one in the population. So as advanced practice providers, we're going to have to make informed decisions about prescribing these products. Which product do we want? Making sure our institutions have protocols in place so that we don't have things interchanged when they shouldn't be interchanged, and that we're documenting drugs effectively in terms of monitoring adverse events. We have to educate our peers, which will include everyone from the billing manager to the chairside nurse taking care of the patient. Our patients will definitely have questions, and we'll definitely have to explain to our patients why they're getting this drug and not that drug, or why was there a change in their drug. That might even be driven by third-party payers as we go forward in the future. And we will definitely be collaborating with our pharmacy colleagues. Our pharmacy colleagues, especially if interchangeability is a future thing that will happen, we need to know. If we wrote a prescription for a drug and it was substituted at the level of the pharmacy, we want to know that. The pharmacist would not be required to tell us that by the true definition of interchangeability, so we need to collaborate with these folks. We have to make sure we're talking to our pharmacy people and knowing where our patients are getting their medications. Pharmacovigilance is a responsibility all advanced practice providers have. The World Health Organization has a bit of a cumbersome definition. I like the FDA's definition because it kind of cuts to the quick. And this is all scientific and data gathering activities related to the detection, assessment, and understanding of adverse events. Most of this is taking place in the post-marketing scene. So what happens is the drug is introduced as this biosimilar has been introduced. We're seeing patients, we're prescribing for patients, and we're having to monitor those patients for adverse events that maybe weren't recorded in the clinical trials. Well, our responsibility is to report that. What if the patient reports it to the manufacturer? What if the patient reports it to the FDA? And then what if we get one of those pieces of paper in our mailbox that's about this thick, you know, that wants us to fill out what happened and what the side effects were and what was going on? You know, what we can't do is put that in the trash because we didn't report it. We didn't see it. It's not our responsibility. It's everybody's responsibility to be pharmacovigilant. That's the way we're going to know what these drugs are doing and if anything develops around these drugs that didn't take place in the clinical trials. It's a voluntary process, but really for advanced practice providers, it's not really voluntary. It's a responsibility. Lastly, you'll need to keep up at your state level about what's happening in terms of legislation. The map you see here is from October. It was just updated. What you probably have in your slides was the one from July, but this was just updated based on some states that had come forth. And what this means is the state's position on interchangeability. So, for example, here in Arizona where we are, there was legislation filed, but it was adjourned. In Tennessee, the state I practice in, legislation has passed, and what that legislation says is that they will honor interchangeability. The state will honor interchangeability. So if a drug receives an interchangeable status, the pharmacist may substitute that drug without the knowledge of the prescribing healthcare provider. So I'd like to close by saying that I appreciate the opportunity to be here from JADPRO Live. A lot goes into this conference. It's a wonderful, amazing conference. I've never missed a JADPRO Live, and I hope that I don't miss a JADPRO Live. And I'd like to thank you all also for your time and attention. And I know you're going to come up with some great ideas about this in the future. And I wanted to leave you with a quote by Nancy Lynn Newhall because I think it speaks to biosimilarity. And it says, "The wilderness holds answers to more questions than we have yet learned to ask." And I think that's where we are with the launch of our first biosimilar. We're going to have questions. There's going to be things come up that we don't have the answers to. But I have no doubt that, as always, advanced practice providers will rise to the occasion, will track down the answers, and will get these drugs safely incorporated into our patient population.
This concludes this podcast from the 2015 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference. To view these slides and claim your educational credit, or to view other programs from this meeting, please visit education.annenberg.net/JADPRO Live 2015.